A very busy Thursday, December 17th, right here on Connecticut Today as we dug out from a midweek snowstorm. Vin Candelora, incoming House Republican leader in the 3 o'clock hour, talked about a plan his caucus has to help out more small business owners, particularly restaurants, as we still deal with COVID-19. Governor Ned Lamont gave the latest on COVID-19 in a 4 p.m. briefing. And Jonathan Wharton, associate professor of political science at Southern Connecticut State University, stopped by to start off the 5 o'clock hour to chat about politics both in Connecticut and nationally. Right now was Republican State House Minority Leader Vin Candelora of North Brantford. Vin, Paul here again. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks to have me on here, Paul.
Yeah, Vin, I know you got together with some leaders, and the governor kind of gave it half a mention, too, in some press availabilities he did yesterday. I think he mentioned it during Middletown and some other areas as well when he was talking about various things. Middlesex, rather, the Chamber of Commerce, talking about various things, challenges that he and the state are facing. What to do, Vin, about trying to do what the state can regarding bar owners, restaurant owners, people who are being asked to take a hit because of COVID, but really are not getting enough of a helping hand, people would think, and maybe how the state is or is not stepping up. And I know you had an idea, a proposal. Talk a little about the scenario here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where we are is back in March when a lot of businesses were asked to abruptly close. The federal government had stepped up, and we saw the Paycheck Protection Program go into place. We saw the heightened unemployment funds where the federal had bumped up the unemployment. And unfortunately, going into the second wave of this pandemic, we're not seeing that same support, yet we're seeing even greater restrictions being put on our businesses. You know, the state of Connecticut got about $1.4 billion of federal aid to deal with the pandemic-related issues. And House Republicans believe that we need to start paying attention to our economy and putting some of that money toward it. I think we're one of the few states, in my opinion, I think we've spent the least of most states toward propping up our economy. And in the long run, we're going to suffer for it. And so the latest proposal we've had is to create a $50 million fund with the CARES Act money to support our hospitality, our restaurant industry, who has been undergoing the most restrictions so far with this pandemic. And the grant program would be roughly anywhere from $2,000 to $25,000 per restaurant, and they can make application. And the intent is that, you know, as the vaccines are rolling out, it's going to be a long time before in-house dining picks up again to where it used to be. And we want to keep these businesses afloat to get into the spring, because once they close, they're not going to come back. You know, and that's our worry.
Yeah. Vin, hang on. I want to be right back with you because I know in the news availability, the press availability you folks did the other day, I learned something about something that our neighboring states are doing. Hang on, more with Republican State Rep, the House Minority Leader for the coming term, Vin Candelora. Vin, hang on. Traffic and weather together at 3:36 on WICC. Should local businesses in and around Fairfield and New Haven counties who've been curtailed or maybe completely shut down, in the case of, say, bars and other facilities and other businesses, because of COVID-19, should they be getting more monetary assistance from the state? And why is that not happening? We're talking to Republican North Brantford State Rep Vin Candelora, the incoming House Minority Leader, and he and his caucus put together some ideas for this the other day. The governor, in a news availability yesterday, acknowledged they were there. Said that he was thinking of some stuff as well. Vin, a member of your caucus here, I see in this story in the News Junkie, I did not realize that Massachusetts was giving businesses grants of up to $75,000, and some Rhode Island businesses are getting grants of up to $30,000. Is any of that happening here in Connecticut? And if not, why not?
No, I mean, the one program that the state did was put a grant program together for $5,000 grants for businesses who had to apply through our Department of Economic and Community Development. That application process occurred roughly a month ago. Checks still have not gone out. So Connecticut is a little bit slow in moving to support our businesses. And, you know, unfortunately, I think we continue to borrow for the unemployment fund because there's such a heavy draw on it in our state, which, by the way, is paid for by the business community, not by tax dollars. So our businesses are essentially being taxed about, when this is all said and done, about $2.5 billion of business taxes have gone into the unemployment compensation fund. We're just asking to create a program to give them $500 million to keep this segment of our economy going, which has been so dramatically hurt by the pandemic.
What about then tapping into the rainy day fund? Would that be something that you would be receptive to or not? I know the governor tends to be very protective of that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the rainy day fund is there for other reasons. It was structured to sort of try to essentially pay down all of the unfunded liabilities because Connecticut has one of the highest unfunded liability in our pensions in the country. But, you know, the federal government gave us about $1.5 billion of CARES Act money, and it's about prioritization. And we should be using that money for things other than just the direct impact of the virus. We've put all the money into the healthcare systems. And what House Republicans want government to start looking at is that there's other things impacted by this virus than just the health aspects. There is an economic aspect to it that's going to create other problems for us in the long run. You know, the mental health impacts of people struggling with their businesses cause other problems. And so all of this matters, and we need to, I think, branch out our focus and start putting some resources into propping up our jobs in this economy.
You know, Vin, I have said constantly throughout this whole thing that if a government or a governmental body, I don't care what party it is, Democrat, Republican, left, right, up, down, if they are ordering you to either completely keep your business shuttered, like bars and others here in the state, or ordering you, Vin, to severely curtail, with good reason, with a deadly disease out there, saying, you know, you cannot operate as usual, so you're limping along with some money coming in. You know, Vin, call me old-fashioned or call me just pie in the sky here, Pollyanna, whatever. I think that that governmental agency or that governmental branch has a moral responsibility because of something they did to you to cut down your cash flow or even put you out of business. They should do everything on God's earth to help you recoup that. And I am just stunned here at how little is being done in the state to do that. I really are. I never thought I would see this and the state saying, well, here's a few crumbs, too bad. Because that's what, to me, Vin, that's what it looks like is happening.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the level of arrogance that comes out of government is pretty scary. When we did our first proposals, you know, not only did the governor say that our proposals were dumb, but he also made the comment that, you know, we need to worry about our local governments being able to pay our teachers and our firefighters and our policemen. And what's shocking to that statement, and there's no recognition of those businesses that need to generate the income to pay those taxes that pays those teachers. And, you know, I own a business that we've been closed for almost 5 months because of this pandemic. And the thought of January 1st, we need to now pay an unemployment tax because the unemployment fund has been bankrupt. We have to institute a payroll tax for the paid family medical leave program that the Democrats put in, and they're refusing to delay it by 90 days. And then we have to pay our property taxes by February 1st. We are setting ourselves up for a perfect storm in the middle of this pandemic, and the lack of recognition is frustrating. And part of it arises out of the fact that, you know, you have the financial markets doing very well. So the white-collar businesses aren't impacted the same way that Main Street is impacting. And I think that, you know, our governor, if he's focusing on the financial sector and the health market, doesn't appreciate what is really going on in Main Street. And that's why, you know, we're putting forth this proposal, because we've got to pay more attention to our Main Street businesses.
Absolutely. Vin Candelora, Vin, thank you. Have a good weekend. We'll talk down the line. If we don't talk, have a happy holiday season. We'll talk in a bit. Vin Candelora, Vin, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, there you go. Yes, and Vin is a business owner, too. He owns a rather well-equipped outdoor sports facility, numerous fields and indoor facilities, too. So there's a guy, too, who, you know, like he said, he was closed all summer when he would be at the, you know, pardon me, at the height of his earning power to then eventually pay all those taxes, state income tax, federal income tax, you know, the new family and medical leave tax, unemployment tax. Folks, it's just, I'm really disappointed in this one aspect of how the state has handled this. We're going to tell you to close. You know, if you're a bar owner, or I guess gyms are back open now, but, you know, we're going to tell you to close. And, yeah, but I have bills. Yeah, but you know what? That's not our problem. Well, no, you know. And again, folks, like I say here, now granted, different states are, you know, concerned with different things or have different intricacies there. But, again, the state of Massachusetts, for example, according to this that I see here in this story from the Connecticut News Junkie, the state of Massachusetts is giving some businesses, not all, I mean, it obviously goes by payroll and staffing, some businesses are getting grants of up to $75,000 to help stay afloat. Rhode Island, $30,000. Here, it's crumbs. It's too bad.
And not to mention, COVID doesn't take a snow day either. And to all of our first responders, those doing the testing, those doing the vaccinations, the nurses and doctors, thank you for what you're doing. Here to give a brief COVID update with Paul and Josh as well. Let's take a look at the numbers. All right, what you see here is a lot of cases, a lot of tests. 6.46 positivity rate, that's the 7-day rolling average. It's worth noting that we all spiked up in and around Thanksgiving, talking to Governor Baker just this afternoon about that. And everybody has flattened a little bit since that flare-up from Thanksgiving. You'll see here that the number currently hospitalized is down 49. That's extraordinary good news. The number of fatalities is up, and that's bad news. Harry? Next up, here's on the good news front. The vaccines continue. We've administered over 1,982. We'll have all the vaccines that are allocated for the hospitals administered by the end of tomorrow. Focused really on our healthcare workforce, as you know. In addition, all of the vaccines have arrived for our nursing homes. We made a big priority of that. A special shout out to Josh and Deirdre, knowing how we were hit by what happened in the nursing homes back in the spring. We're one of the first four states in the country to be able to start vaccinating nursing home patients as well as the nurses tomorrow. And for that, we're very, very thankful. A little bit of confusion, part on my part, regarding Pfizer. Their supply forecast was slightly reduced. Less than what we thought. They have assured us that they have in stockpile all the vaccine they need to meet commitments. I think that was a bit of a supply chain issue, but mitigated by the fact that they provided more doses per vial than they had anticipated as well. So that meant that, well, we were shortchanged a little bit. Moderna picked up, so we're only down about 13%. And gives you an idea of some of the supply chain management that we're going through right now. Finally, we're going to hear from CDC and others down in Washington, D.C., final guidance on phase 1B. As you know, phase 1 is related to those frontline healthcare responders, doctors, nurses. Secondly, in and around the nursing homes where we're getting started right now. And I think everything is on track to make sure that phase one group is going to have their first and second vaccine before the end of January. Then you move into phase 1B. This next chart, I just wanted to remind you a little bit about how important this vaccine is, especially those folks who are on the front line taking care of people afflicted by COVID every day. They know what it means in a way for some of us that maybe seems more theoretical. So Onyema is someone who struck a chord with me. He wrote, as a researcher who worked on the vaccine, as an infectious disease specialist who has been on the front lines of caring for patients with COVID-19, as a dad of three kids who are never impressed with anything I do in any way, as a person of color, I think it's been really gratifying to be part of this process. And there he is at the culmination of that process. So he'll be able to be safe so he can go take care of a lot of people we know in the hospital over the course of the next number of months. Let me change tacks just for 1 minute here. We're at the near the end on our CARES Act money, that $1.35 billion that we got some months ago. We hope we're getting close in terms of what the feds are going to do next, but we couldn't wait. So this is worth noting. Whatever the feds do next is not going to be much help to state and local government. So we wanted to do everything we could to help our municipalities, local towns and municipalities. So Melissa McCall and our team at OPM have got $60 million allocated to our towns and cities. That money is going to start going out next week. Of that, 45 plus million of that is related to distributing support for ongoing public health expenses, including COVID enforcement, public safety, ways that we can help you manage costs that you may have. That's in addition to about 14 and a half that's already been distributed. That was based upon your allocation of costs you showed us related to COVID. And we got you paid back for everything you asked us for. FEMA's a little slow at making their payments, to be blunt about it. They haven't made a payment, I'm told, since in this fiscal year. So we wanted to catch up. The additional $15 million for our towns and cities is going to be to provide for priority testing. So kids get back and school starts again in January. Make sure that we have our teachers and staff, have some opportunity to get testing early on. This is in addition to the money we've been able to provide for small business and what else we're trying to do. As you know, we've David Lehman and his team over at DECD have been sending out 10,000 checks to the smallest businesses with 20 or fewer employees. Some of these businesses maybe weren't equipped to get the PPP money. In addition, David will start rolling out the $25 million grant program for slightly larger businesses to help be a bridge to support. Because look, things are slowing down here. We got a snowstorm. We got the holiday season post-Christmas. That's not good business for restaurants or retail and a lot of others who could use some support. So that's the support we're going to try and provide. It does look like there's going to be a $300 billion paycheck protection program coming out of the federal government, of which that's about $300 million for the state of Connecticut and our small business. So we're a bridge to getting the relief they need. In addition, there'll be a substantial money and close to agreed upon federal program for rent relief, which is going to be incredibly important. So money for hospitals. Some money for educational support. So that's what we hope we'll be able to count upon, and we ought to have some clarity on that, over the next, say, 3-4 days. A little tough to predict, to tell you the truth. Lastly, all of the governors I have talked to, and I think you've seen this across the country, there was a surge, not unexpected, and the surge in and around related to Thanksgiving, in and around those informal social gatherings. And we all paid a price for that. Maybe that's leveling out now. We'll see. But let's not let that happen again. You know, we're a week away from Christmas Eve, we're in the middle of Hanukkah. There's an opportunity for some a lot of social gatherings. And I just really need you to be careful. One, stay within your household and join your friends and family more broadly outside of your immediate household. Do that virtually. It'll make an enormous difference. That's the lowest risk way you can do it. You know, medium risk is, you know, indoor gatherings. Make sure it's well-ventilated spaces. Open the windows even though it's cold. Wear the mask if you're with folks who aren't, you know, you're not very close to, not a part of your immediate family cohort. And obviously better to be outside, but you better buckle up. And finally, you can see here what the highest risk places are. Avoid that. Let's not let happen next week what happened in and around Thanksgiving. We're making real progress in this. The vaccines are beginning to make a difference. We're providing some support out there for our small businesses and other impacted groups. We got money out for our not-for-profits, close to $100 million. Got money for our performing arts and the arts. We're doing what we can, and I think this next few weeks should be the time to be merry. It's also a time to be cautious. Let's see what questions we got for Paul, Josh, and myself.
We'll start with Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Good afternoon, everyone. Have there been backups in COVID testing because of the snowstorm? And if so, do you all expect a spike in numbers when it reopens after cleanup?
Vaccinations are proceeding on pace. How about the testing, Josh?
Yeah, we know a lot of testing sites were closed today because of storm-related impacts, and some of the labs were down a little capacity as well, but I wouldn't expect a major backup from that at this point.
And then, Governor Lamont, what are your thoughts on the letter from the Connecticut Brewers Guild, specifically asking for assistance for breweries and a change to the sit-down full dining to drink a beer, rollbacks for that?
Well, they'll certainly be eligible for the $25 million grant program that kicks off next week. Otherwise, I'm not really inclined to relax the protocols. I mean, breweries, bars, places that you're taking off your mask, you're socializing, having a drink, even if you're sitting down, is risky behavior. I think we're going to have to be strict a little bit longer.
Thank you.
News 8.
Hi, Governor. It's Jody Latina. I'm curious, do you know how many tractor trailers took the opportunity to pull over and stay the night at Sherwood Island State Park and also at Hammonasset?
Jody, I don't think it was that many. I think it was less than a dozen.
And the ban on tractor trailers helped out?
I think it helped out a lot. A tractor trailer spinning out, gets out of control, can jam up traffic and slow up snow plowing, takes a lot of cops and others there to have to get that cleaned up. I think it made a big difference. That allowed us, as well as our neighboring states, we did this in coordination to get the roads back and operable a lot faster.
NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. First off, is the state aware of any storm-related hospitalizations, and just overall, how is our capacity right now?
Well, as you see, our hospitalization was down today. I think you'll find our hospitalization has been flat now for a couple of weeks, which is remarkable good news. Makes a big difference. I haven't heard of any storm-related issues at the hospitals, no.
And then just kind of going off of the hospitalizations, I know you said that was kind of a key metric. Also, in terms of building up more facilities like what's happening at the convention center, how soon do you potentially see that being used?
Nothing imminent, I don't believe. last time they were very rarely used, but it is a little bit of capacity. It gives us some breathing room as we make our way through this last of the holiday couple of weeks and see what it looks like.
And are you pretty confident we have enough medical personnel right now to be able to staff the hospitals as well as these alternate facilities?
Well, I can tell you that Josh and Deirdre ask the CEOs every day, and they do have some additional capacity depending on, you know, the non-urgent electives, most of which shut down 6 months ago. They're doing some, you know, mild slowdowns right now, so I think there could be some additional personnel available if needed.
And just lastly, we, you know, we had heard about the first nursing home potentially vaccinating patients as soon as tomorrow. How quickly do you see that expanding across the state?
I think very quickly. You're going to see a lot of vaccines going for all of the nursing homes next week, and I think that's going to be part of a concerted rollout.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Fox 61.
Hi, Governor. Zania Maldonado, Fox 61. I know you mentioned all recent planned Pfizer vaccine deliveries were successful prior to the storm, and we had nearly 2,000 administered so far. But what was the total amount of vaccines received here in Connecticut, and when will we see another round of shipments?
I think we got 15,500, 16, something in that area, and I think we expect our next shipment early next week. Josh is nodding.
Right. We received all 31,600 doses into Connecticut that were forecasted and ordered for this week, including Walgreens and CVS, confirming that they've gotten their allocation that we put in for them. And as the governor said, we expect another set of shipments next week.
Wise and nationally, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Associate Professor of Political Science at Southern Connecticut State University. Now, John, last time we talked, you were, it was election night, and yeah. and you were in, I think it was keeping an eye on the set for you, watching what was going on, and grading papers or doing lesson plans or something like that?
Well, yeah, it was a bit of that, and then, of course, this week, that's all I've been doing is grading, so... You know, it's been an active month for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I saw your tweet the other night. Very funny, but we won't go into that.
Well, of course.
Twitter's a wonderful thing. Well, it's now election day, election night, plus about 5 weeks here. Before we get to the national stuff, John, Connecticut here. No surprise that the Democrats maintain their majorities in the state House and state Senate, but the, you know, the Republicans, John, they took another hit. They lost two more seats in the state Senate, a few more in the state House, and probably a blowback by the anti-Trump vote. But boy, the Republicans in this state, who just a couple of cycles ago were actually doing much better, now it's a few steps back again.
It is, although I did argue in an op-ed for Connecticut News Junkie last month, I think it's also a fresh start for the Republican State Party next year. I think many of your listeners know or should be reminded that, you know, gubernatorial election is going to happen in 2022. So if we see on the horizon that the party chair's race is taking place in June and the Republican State Central Committee is going through their selection nomination process this spring, you know, a change is afoot. And this could be an opportune time for the state party and even the local parties for what could happen next year for the governor's race, but also just the statewide races.
There's a story that broke today that's kind of interesting in the Connecticut Mirror that I was just talking about last hour. We're kind of, you know, John, Seaback has fired the opening salvo here to the governor, saying, hey, don't push us on these mandatory retirements or the suggested retirements as purge in 2022. Don't go nuts with these modernization efforts, you know, streamlining. That's language, John, that a lot of state employees in this state are not used to hearing from a Democratic governor. So the next few months, maybe years or so, going to be interesting to see how it actually does shake out with the legislature, with the state employees, and with the governor.
It is. And actually, it was interesting. I was a part of listening into the Board of Regents meetings this morning, certainly for Southern Connecticut State University and the other regional universities and community colleges, because many of those unions are really bringing that up. They've introduced it. They spoke at the meeting. It was certainly a pronounced meeting this morning. And so, look, the union is going to be outspoken about it. We're seeing the pushback certainly by the Board of Regents. Marco Jakian, who is the systems, University Systems President, brought that out towards the end of the meeting. I think this is only the beginning point of it. The fascinating thing that both sides brought out was the fact that this is all being brought out through the media, and they're not even right now at the negotiation stage. A lot of this is just discussion and talk and rhetoric. We're not going to see anything really be cemented for a little bit, but we're clearly seeing the lines being drawn. I also want to add one other dynamic, too. Yeah. We can't ignore, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't forget the silver tsunami. I mean, we're right on the verge of this. And the estimations, especially for the public universities and community colleges, that we might see somewhere near a third of these retirements taking place
yep.
with these CBAC contracts. So we can't forget so much of the state employees are baby boomers. And that's going to be transformative with some of these discussions taking place with the contract.
Do you think it's possible? Nothing's impossible, I guess. But if things got really testy, John, over the next year or so, you think Lamont might get a primary challenge from his left, you think?
No one knows. It could be possible because we know the divisions are there within every party. We see it certainly play out nationally. But in Connecticut, we can't ignore it. Let me say this. A younger generation of folk, candidates, politicians, public officials, are leaning more liberal. And so that could come out, especially among a younger generation, than not just so much maybe a liberal or centrist.
Sure. To the national scene, John. Boy, this is amazing. You've got the president who he knows he lost. This is all posturing, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. You've got a guy that is, you know, universally despised by about 80 or 81 million people. And loved to some extent by 74 million people. And you've got huge vote totals. And I know there's a lot of Republican hand washing now. Oh, he's finally going to be gone. But it's interesting that the people who despise this guy on the GOP side, mainly the McCain wing and the Bush wing, nobody in their camp, John, can draw 20,000-30,000 people to a rally at the drop of a hat. Man, it is. There's some strange times out there.
Well, it's also a good reminder of how populism plays to a base. A lot of this does motivate people to participate, engage, and vote, for good or for bad. And so there's got to be some kind of element within both parties, or even the Republican Party, to continue on. That will draw the same kind of interest. I don't know if you're going to see that so much for the next 4 years. And I'm not just saying, by the way, for the midterm elections, which you can't forget in a couple of years, right? But even in terms of how this will trickle down for even state and local races, including certainly the ones in Connecticut. We can't forget the next year is going to be many of these municipal races.
Mm-hmm.
And as I have said, the governor's race and the statewide races the year after that. So there's a lot at play here of what happened last month for the future.
And I keep seeing these pieces, in The Hill, John, and Politico, a lot of the stuff I'm sure you read. Because I have no social life. I'm sure you do. They keep asking the question, how can a Republican be Trump without being Trump? You know, the populism thing. How does the GOP electrify people the way that Donald Trump did, for better or for worse?
Well, and not to mention also brought in so many of these kind of disaffected voters, people who weren't engaged or weren't participating, who were unaffiliated. Many of them still are unaffiliated voters who aren't even tied to the Republican Party. How do you bring that in? And how does that translate to the state and local races? That's going to be the big unknown. I'm not saying that Trump and helped electrify that. It was a good part of it. But something else has to maybe replace that void, or maybe even arguably continue it.
Why did he do better with minority voters, John, than any Republican since 1960? Why did that happen?
I think that when you are faced with the moment like we've been for so long economically, I mean, really, I'm not even saying what's happened this year during a pandemic, but prior with the Great Recession and all, many minority communities were slammed and affected by the Great Recession. And some of that still lingered during the Obama years. And so that was widely politicized. One thing, too, to bring up, Paul, is the gender gaps even among minority communities. It's amazing to see the number of Latino and Black men who even supported Donald Trump. And it's not a huge number, right? I mean, we're talking barely double digits, but it's certainly been a higher number than what it was in the past.
Yeah. And finally, John, give me a couple of scenarios here. If the Republicans hold the Senate in the January 5th runoffs, or if the Democrats sweep and then Kamala Harris breaks all the ties, so the Democrats effectively control the Senate, what are the two scenarios you think that could shake out there?
You know, it's going to be such a razor-thin division. And I think it's easy to say, well, red, blue. It's a little more complicated in the U.S. Senate. Few people probably know, I worked for a half dozen years actually in Congress as a congressional aide. And the Senate is such a unique institution because it's not always about political parties. In many instances, it's about personalities and certainly egos. And so we're having one individual represent an entire state along with somebody else. So there are a number of different factors that play out in the Senate that's uniquely different than in the House. And so it'd be easy to tie things to party, but a lot of it's going to come down to ego, personality, and just the personal politics somewhat. I mean, look at the difference in somebody like John McCain and somebody like Susan Collins, senators from unique states where they didn't always toe the party line. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, even if it is going to be a split between one party or the other.
And then you have finally, Jonathan, you've got the dynamic in the House, too, where, yeah, Speaker Pelosi is going to be Speaker, but boy, there's no way they could have seen those Republican wins coming. There's no way they could have seen that.
Well, and that's one thing I've been following so much on social media, I think you know already, Paul. I mean, God knows I love Twitter for this, because as you mentioned, The Hill, Roll Call, many of these, you know, Washington Post, Washington Times, they play that out. That what's going on in the House is going to be really a big factor. I know everybody's consumed by the Senate. I'd be interested in what's going on in the House, and still will be, especially for Nancy Pelosi's leadership, because it's continuing. And yet there's going to be that splintering. We know that within the caucus for the Democrats.
John, as always, great stuff. Dr. Jonathan Wharton, he's an associate professor and the internship coordinator, poli-sci department at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. John, as always, great stuff. Take care of yourself. Stay healthy. Stay well. Happy holidays, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Good man there. Jonathan Wharton, Southern Connecticut State University. All you Southern boys, Southern guys, Southern gals, right, Eric? Go Owls.